This presentation is brought to you by Submedia. You can check us out online at submedia.tv.
I don't know if you know this, but the original draft of the movie Star Wars was not written by Lucas. The original draft was written by environmentalists, and it's a little bit different. And I don't know, is there anybody in here who does not know the plot of the movie Star Wars? Oh, that's great. There's actually like three people. That's wonderful. I saw that movie again a couple years ago. It's really horrible. I saw it in the 1970s when I was in high school, which is about the right time to see it. It's like, oh, God, the acting is so good. And, I wasn't one of those nerds who saw it like 1,000 times or anything. I mean, besides which I was too busy playing Dungeons & Dragons. But the plot, for those of you who haven't seen it, is that there's the Empire builds this giant machine the size of a moon called the Death Star, and it moves around destroying planets. And of course, it's a great metaphor for the dominant culture. And at some point, the rebels figure out a way to blow up the Death Star. So Luke Skywalker uses the Force to get past all the TIE fighters. I'm not a nerd. And he then gets up real close to the Death Star, and he drops a torpedo down the thermal exhaust port and blows up the Death Star. And anyway, that's how the version that was eventually made goes. But the first version was not like that. The first version written by environmentalists, in that version, the rebels do not, of course, blow up the Death Star, but instead they prefer to use other tactics to slow the intergalactic march of Empire. For example, they set up programs for people on planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. Audience members will also discover there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. The purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edges of their seats, other groups of rebels will file lawsuits against the Empire, attempting to show that the environmental impact statement Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support its decision that blowing up the planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors. And they'll leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. Scribbled in the margin is a note from one of the screenwriters. For accuracy's sake, when we show examples of these letters, it's imperative that all letters to Mr. Vader be respectful and courteous, and that they stress the need to find cooperative solutions to the differences between the rebels and the Empire. Under no circumstances should the letters be such that they would alienate or anger Mr. Vader. If the letters upset Mr. Vader, the rebels' letter campaign to the Grand Moff Tarkin will certainly fail as well. Other plans include sending petitions and filing lawsuits. Now, we all know that all of that would be sufficient not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of the mainstream rebels, decide, in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to the eyes of even the most cold-hearted theatergoers, to stand on the planets about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few rebels sneak aboard the Death Star and lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment. And stirring debates are held on screen among the rebels as to whether they should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels are never able to come to consensus. Which, by the way, I can tell you why there's not going to be a revolution. And that's because I was down in Florida a few years ago, and after the event, there was maybe a dozen of us anarchists were going to go out to dinner. And we spent 45 minutes in the parking lot trying to come to consensus on who gets in which car. We never did come to consensus. Finally, this one woman just said, look, you four this car, you five this car, you three this car. We're like, okay. So actually, that's how it's going to happen, is the way the revolution is going to come, is she just has to call it. Anyway, once inside the Death Star, a splinter group breaks off from those about to lock themselves down, and they rush down long hallways, somehow avoiding all the troopers, and they burn a couple of transporters and use chemicals to etch Galaxy Liberation Front on the walls of the Death Star. And that group miraculously escapes back to the planet about to be destroyed, where they're held by the peaceful protesters so they can rightly be turned over to the troopers. And near the end of the movie, another debate is held among the rebels. And that was actually a problem I had with this screenplay, was that there was a bit too much debate and not quite enough action. We may recognize that. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels advocate picking up weapons to fight back. And they're generally shouted down by the pacifist rebels, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. They state that the rebels who want to fight back are simply being co-opted by the need to control things. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. We must above all else have compassion for Darth Vader. Remember that he too was once a child. One writer put in the margins, excellent, that will be sure to moisten the cheeks of sensitive people everywhere. And he didn't mention whether those tears would be of frustration. Finally, Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up and tell the others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And the rest of the rebels are just horrified. And they say, voices firm behind the sobs, you cannot blow up the Death Star. What about the janitors? And so in the final exciting scene of the environmentalist version, a scuffle breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, and Chewbacca and the two robots on one side and the pacifists on the other. And the pacifists chase those six from the room and from the film, and they're never seen again, which really isn't that big a deal because they're minor characters anyway. And so what happens is the Death Star gets bigger and bigger. It looms closer and closer to the planet. So you see the Death Star, you see the planet, you see the Death Star, you see the planet, and you see the Death Star, and you see the lasers start to glow this hellish red as they warm up. And then you see the planet, and then you see this little spark as and that's the environmentalist getting away before the planet's blown up. And then you see the Death Star, and then the Death Star shoots out the lasers and blows up the planet. And then the final shot of the movie, which reveals what a complete triumph this was for the rebels, is a still showing an article on the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times that devotes a full 3 sentences to the destruction of the planet. It's like, yeah, we got some press. I was giving a talk a couple years ago in Ashland, North Carolina, and during the Q&A afterwards, this one guy raised his hand, and I called on him, and he said, how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And I said, I don't know, I'll bet. I mean, I'll bite. How many? And he said, it wasn't a riddle. And I'm like, that's not how this is supposed to work. And so later that night in my hotel room, I was really obsessing on this question of how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb, and I came up with an answer, which is 10. 1 to write the light bulb a letter requesting that it change, 4 to circulate online petitions, 1 to file a lawsuit demanding that it change, 1 to send the light bulb loving kindness, knowing that's the only way that real change occurs, 1 to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself, 1 to write a book about how and why the light bulb needs to change, and finally, 1 to smash the fucking light bulb, because we all know it's never going to change. Oh, before I go on, I should have done this before. I have some thanks. I would like to thank T. Rubin, and I would like to thank the Cooper Union, and I would like to thank Phil, Bill, Dan, and the gang for organizing the event. And so let's have a pause for all of them. Oh, this, by the way, is also how I know we're not going to have a revolution, because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. As a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss, and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed. And I've sat silent near empty streams that 2 generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of those cartoons I'd seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use it lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, so Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they'd capsize, so large that horses were afraid to get in the water, so large that you could hear them for miles before you'd see them? so large you couldn't see the bottom of the river. Or maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons, and they were here. They were so large that they darkened the sky for days at a time, flying 60 miles an hour, sounding like thunder. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of Eskimo curlews. They're almost as large. Maybe it'll take the death of the great ox. We all know that there are penguins in the southern hemisphere and no penguins in the northern hemisphere, but do we know why? The reason is because they were eradicated by this culture. There were great ox, as what they were called, penguins. They were called by the Portuguese, means the fat ones. There were so many on islands that early French explorers said that they could load every ship in France with them, and it wouldn't make a difference. And they did, and it did. So maybe it'll take dioxin, every mother's breast milk. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take global warming. Maybe it'll take 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. And the response by Michael Sissonwine, who's head of the National Marine Fisheries Service's division overseeing the murder of the oceans, his response was, that's not a problem. We have to ask what level of decline is reasonable or sustainable. Unfortunately, I can't give you his address. I don't have it. He, in those two sentences, he has destroyed the words problem, decline, reasonable, and sustainable, as well as the oceans. And so anyway, this friend was saying, so what's it going to take, Derek? Give me a threshold at which you finally use that word. All over the country, I ask people, do you believe that this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody ever says yes. Most often people laugh. At one of my talks, this one guy raised his hand. Everybody looked at him. He said, oh, voluntary. No, of course not. And the point is, of course, that we will be living in a sane and sustainable way at some point, or we won't be living at all. But will it be voluntary? No. I mean, every cell in my body wants that, but it's not going to happen. So the next question is, if you don't believe the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, and you love the land where you live, or you love life itself, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. And a little bit later in the talk, if I have time, I'm going to bash hope, which is one of my favorite things to do. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is talk about endgame some. And one of the things I do in that book is I lay out my premises in boldface. And one of the reasons I do that is because one of the first rules of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you got them. And I don't want to cheat that way. So, for example, you hear some talking head on television say, how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Good question. How can we make it grow? Well, premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? Hitler did the same thing. How can we best solve the Jewish problem? God, Adolf, good question. Well, what's the premise? That there's a Jewish problem that needs to be solved. It was said of Hitler that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So once you've got your premises by people, you've got them. What are we going to do about our brave servicemen, blah, blah, blah. I mean, if you start off a story about brave servicemen, that's going to be a different story than if you start off talking about people in the military, if you start off talking about war criminals, or if you start off talking about mercenaries. Those are all different spins that go on. So I want to lay them out as explicitly as I can. And premise one is civilization is not and can never be sustainable. Especially industrial civilization, but civilization itself is not and can never be sustainable. A few years ago, I was riding in a car with a friend of mine and stuck in traffic, and I was making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology, what would it be? And George was in a terrible mood, and he said, that's a really stupid question, Derek. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the only level of technology that's sustainable is the Stone Age, and we'll be there again someday, and the only question is going to be what's left of the world when we get there. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. This is preaching to the choir at this place, but if for example, your economy is based on, choose a random example, oil. And eventually you're going to run out. And it might not be a bad idea to think about what you're going to do when that happens. And once again, any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last forever. It's not sustainable by definition. But I would go further, and I would say that any way of life based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. If every year there are fewer salmon returned than the year before, unless you're Michael Sissonwine, eventually you're going to run out. If every year there are fewer passenger pigeons than there were the year before, eventually you're going to run out. And they were, in the meantime, really, really cheap here in New York City. And so any way of living based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last, or based on the hyper-exploitation of non-renewable resources. And I know we've all been fed this long line about how evolution is based on competition, but that's really nonsense, and I can sort of show the stupidity of our entire culture's discourse, because I can disprove that in one sentence if you give me a couple of semicolons. And that is, those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually benefiting your habitat. Because if you harm your habitat, eventually, as we see, your habitat's going to be destroyed. I'm going to take it a step further, though, and I'm going to say that any way of living that's based on the use of resources won't last. Because resources don't exist. Salmon don't consider themselves resources. They're salmon. Trees don't consider themselves timber resource. They're trees. It's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. And it's the same no matter whether we're talking about trees or salmon or women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'm going to treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. Now, definitely segueing away from women, it's just because you don't perceive it as a resource doesn't mean that you can't, like for salmon or trees, doesn't mean that you can't kill them. Once again, I'm not talking about women. And a few years ago, I was doing an interview, a radio interview in Spokane, Washington, and the interviewer said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, what's the difference? And I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. And I knew that answer was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, and so I'm required by law to answer every question asked of me. And that afternoon, I went out and I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer right away, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. So if I consume the flesh of Klamath River salmon, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon community. I got in a big argument with this guy a few years ago because he said that because I use toilet paper, I am just as culpable for deforestation as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser. That didn't seem right to me. And so, thank you for laughing. And I finally realized, I went out and asked a tree, because he said, you know, if you don't believe me, go ask a tree. And I asked a tree, and the tree said, you know, you're an animal, you consume things, get over it. And then the tree also made very clear to me that, yes, I am culpable, but not because I use toilet paper. I am culpable for deforestation because I consume the flesh of a tree, but I don't fulfill my end of the bargain because I don't take responsibility for the continuation of that forest community. I am culpable for deforestation, not because I use toilet paper, but because I don't stop Weyerhaeuser. That's a far greater culpability. This is all nice, Derek, but what does it have to do with civilization? You know, I've been bashing civilization for, God, 15 years now, and I thought I probably better finally define it. So with this new book, I define civilization as a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. That's nice, Derek, but what's a city? A city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. Two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living will never be sustainable, because as soon as you require the importation of resources, it means that you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. I know resource is a nasty word, but we're going to use it. And, oh, and by the way, what this means is that the Talawa, on whose land I now live, were not civilized. They didn't live in cities. They lived in villages, camps. They didn't require the importation of resources. And they lived there for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talawa, then they lived there since the beginning of time. And they did that without, once again, importing resources. They did that by because they would eat salmon, they would eat huckleberry, they would eat salal, elk, clams, marine mammals, salmon. And then usually through the winter months, they would eat a lot of salmon. Anyway, so that's one of the things it means, is that if you require the importation of resources, your way of living can never be sustainable, because you've denuded the landscape of that resource. As your city grows, you're going to denude an ever larger area, as we see. The other thing it means, which means we could all become the most wonderful little greenies in the world, and the way of living would still not be sustainable. I was doing a talk up in Massachusetts a couple years ago, and the person said, you know, our way of living is more sustainable now than it was 100 years ago. And the way the person knew this is because he said that there are more forests now in Massachusetts than there were 100 years ago. And I said, yeah, that's because you're getting your wood from South America. You're just exporting the damage. Anyway, the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. So if the people in the next watershed over are not going to give you the resources that you need to survive, they're not going to trade you for them, you'll take them, which means we could all become junior bodhisattvas, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge, because how else are they going to steal the oil they need to run the economy? Okay, so that's the first premise of the book, is that civilization is not and can never be sustainable, and that's right here. So we only have like 15 more premises, so you did bring sleeping bags, right? Actually, because I'm shortening this, we're going to skip the second premise and go to the third. Our way of living is based on requires and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. And I gave a talk in Oregon a couple years ago, and this guy afterwards said, you know, you talk a lot about this culture being based on violence, but I don't see it. You know, I'm not violent. And I said, okay, first off, where's your shirt made? And he looked, and it was made in Bangladesh. It's like, look, do we even need to talk about that? Like, no, he got it. And second, I said, okay, do you pay rent? He's like, yeah. And I said, why? And he said, because I don't own. And I said, no. What would happen if you didn't pay rent? He said, well, the sheriff would come and evict me. I said, I don't know what that means. What would happen? He said, well, the sheriff would come, and he would knock on the door. I said, okay, great. What happens if you open the door, you let him in, and you say, hey, I'm just finishing up making dinner. You want some? And so the sheriff sits down. You feed him. You don't poison him. And after dinner, you say, well, you know, you've been somewhat pleasant company, but not all that pleasant, so I would like for you to leave my home now. What would happen? He said, well, the sheriff would pull out his gun. He'd say, I'm here to evict you because you didn't pay rent. I said, ah, so the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun is going to come and take you away. I said, oh, I think I get it. I said, okay, what happens if you're hungry? So you go to the grocery store, a lot of food there, you know, and you start eating. What's going to happen? So we're going to call the sheriff. I said, yeah, it's the same guy who's going to come with a gun and take you away. He's a real asshole, isn't he? And so the point is that one of the reasons that a lot of us, and I'm excluding women from this, of course, one of the reasons a lot of us don't see the violence around us is, A, because a lot of it is exported to the colonies where the resources are stolen from their communities. And, oh, very, very, very quickly is, and you see why my talks go long, you see also why I write in a nonlinear fashion. You know, the whole thing, the whole immigration brouhaha that's going on, I feel very strongly that it's okay if they close the border to Mexico, to people. I feel great. Yeah, sure. Close the border on one condition, which is you also close it to all resources. Because if you want to close it to the people but not the resources, then, well, you're just... Thanks. You're saying a couple things. One of them is, well, one of the things you're saying is you're a racist asshole. And the other thing you're saying is that I don't want you, but I want the coffee that's grown on land that used to be yours. Because the reason that so many of the people come up is not because they want to take an eco-tour of the strawberry fields of the San Joaquin Valley. You know, they come up because their communities have been destroyed and their land's been stolen. Anyway, so one of the reasons we don't see a lot of the violence is because it's exported. And another reason we don't see a lot of the violence is because we've been so metabolized into the system that we bought into this strange notion that it's okay to have to pay to exist on the planet. That's really, really weird. And if you don't pay, then some guy with a gun is going to come and bad things are going to happen to you. It's very strange. So that's number three. Fourth premise, one of my favorite ones in the book. This culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always invisible or unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable, and when it does occur, is regarded with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. So, for example, you know, in the 1970s, I also saw the movie Jaws. I live like 3 miles from the ocean. I still don't get in the water because of that goddamn movie. But the reality is, and there's this movie a couple years ago, Spring Break Shark Attack. It's like, yeah, it's like, I wish there was that many sharks still left in the world. The ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is about 20 million to one. Another great example of this is my father's extremely violent, and my brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me, beat everybody in the family but me. And the one time my brother fought back, my father beat him far worse than any other time, of course, because my brother had committed blasphemy. He'd sent violence the wrong direction up the hierarchy. Another example. I live in an area that has a lot of bears, and I often walk this path at night with no flashlight or anything, and everybody's like, oh my God, aren't you scared? The bears are going to get you. But there's about one North American dies every year from bear attacks. And at the same time, I believe, and if Jan Lundberg's here, he'll know the real numbers, I think it's like 42,000 Americans die every year because of automobile wrecks. 46,000? Yeah, okay, so, I mean, the truth is, you know, we just, instead of being afraid of bears, it's like we should, you know, walk through a parking lot going, oh my God, like, they're out to get us. And the cars are all like, which is probably more truth to that than we want to admit. Or here's another example, and there's so many examples, but it's another example is, okay, you know, there's between 4 and 6 Americans die every day because they encounter police. That's through beatings, shootings, high-speed chases, and medical neglect in prisons and jails. Yet every time a cop dies, there's a big state funeral. Some gave all gave some. You know, the violence only flows down the highway. I mean, and by the way, I have to tell you, the most dangerous civil service profession is garbage collection, because they're next to all these big machines that are this, and the machines are going after them. And when was the last time you saw a big state funeral for a garbage collector, you know, with the bumper sticker, some gave all gave some? Or when was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where this intrepid garbage man is cleaning up the mean streets of L.A., you know? It's like, it's not going to happen because it doesn't valorize the right sort of violence. And one last example, just to, you know, well, two more examples, is, you know, if you don't believe me, the next time they have, oh, we could have done it today. We could have had a little example today with the whole anti-war demonstration. The next time there's a WTO demonstration, whatever, you know, just take a baseball bat. Walk up to a cop and say, excuse me, Officer Friendly, I'm nothing personal, but I'm just conducting an experiment. Hit him, and then hit him a couple more times real fast, and then I'll talk to him about 60 years. So once again, violence only flows down the hierarchy. And also, you know, it's we'll go on. Fifth premise of the book is the property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It's acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language, to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. That's called production. Thank you. You know, it's one of my favorite lines in the whole talk, and like, you're the first chuckle I've ever gotten out of it. So that like makes my day. Who was it who chuckled? Thank you. Okay. There we go. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language, to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. You know, I don't know if I would prefer a sincere chuckle to like a applause that's out of pity. No, hell, I'll take it. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. Sixth premise. This culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it, and for those who come after. If somebody would have brought down civilization 200 years ago, whatever that means, if Tecumseh would have won, then people in this area after the crash could still eat passenger pigeons. Even ignoring, you know, the beautiful existence of passenger pigeons on their own, there's still a lot of calories. If people would have brought down civilization 100 years ago, people in the Pacific Northwest could still eat salmon. There's going to be people sitting along the Columbia 50 years from now, and they'll be glowing, for one thing, but they'll be starving to death, and they'll be saying, I'm starving to death because you didn't take out the dams that killed salmon. And those dams were used for barging and for electricity, for aluminum smelters, for beer cans. So, God damn you. And, you know, the longer we wait, I mean, if somebody would have brought it down 100 years ago, we wouldn't have to worry about global warming. If somebody would have brought it down 100 years ago, we wouldn't have to worry about carcinogens in every stream, carcinogens in every mother's breast milk. If somebody would have brought it down, I mean, what are we going to do? Are we going to wait 50 years? And in 50 years, are we going to be going, God, if somebody would have brought it down 50 years ago, there'd still be, I don't know, you know, earthworms or something. I don't know. And, well, great apes, we can say for sure. You know, it's like, there would still be great apes. There would still be polar bears. There would still be the great cats. There would still be birds other than pigeons and starlings. It's like, how long are we going to wait? Okay, eighth premise. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I have just guaranteed I will never hold public office. Another way to put the eighth premise. Any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it is based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base. The ninth premise is, although there will clearly someday be far fewer humans than there are at present, there are many ways this reduction in population could occur. Some of the ways would be characterized by extreme violence and privation. Nuclear Armageddon, for example, would certainly reduce both population and consumption. It would do so horrifically. The same would be true for a continuation of overshoot followed by crash. Other ways would be characterized by less violence, or essentially no additional violence. But this much is certain. If we don't approach it actively, if we don't talk about our predicament and what we're going to do about it, the violence will almost undoubtedly be far more severe, the privation more extreme. And actually, that's a good point for me to talk about. I gave a talk a few years ago, and I gave two talks in the same day, and there was this one woman who hated what I had to say so much that she came to both talks. And she accused me of being a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. And that was because bringing down civilization will kill a lot of people. And they killed a lot of people. Ipso facto, I must be like them. And I had multiple responses that I think it's actually a crucial question, and I had multiple responses to it. The first one is that bringing down civilization is not a monolithic act, in that I don't care what your motivation is, I don't care who you are, blowing up a children's hospital would be immoral. It doesn't matter if you are an anarcho-primitivist or if you're a member of the U.S. military. You cannot make a moral case or blowing up well, I guess you can if you're bringing democracy and freedom to a country. which, by the way, I have figured out how to listen to George Bush's speeches without going insane. And, well, one way is, of course, to turn the volume down. And another way, you remember the whole Freedom Fries thing? What you do is, that gave me the clue. That gave me the answer. It's a simple word substitution. So every time they say freedom, substitute the word fascism. Every time they say the word democracy, substitute corporate control. And so it's like, they are bringing freedom and democracy to Iraq. It's true. They're bringing fascism and corporate control to Iraq. And so it's fun to like listen to the whole speech and just do the word substitutions. It's like fun for the whole family. Try it. Oh, and the we thing, and also Iraq reminds me that a really important thing. No, I'll talk about that later if I have time, but I don't think I will. So you're never going to hear it. Anyway, so the first thing is, you know, on one hand, it's almost impossible to make a moral case for blowing up a children's hospital. On the other hand, it's almost impossible to make a moral case against taking out a cell phone tower. And cell phone towers, of course, make it so that jerk at the next table can yammer on when you're trying to eat. And they also send out the electromagnetic waves that make it so you have to wear the aluminum foil beanie. And then the other thing they do is they kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds a year. And once again, it's almost impossible to make a moral case against taking out a cell phone tower. So let's see some sleeves rolled up. So the moralities of different acts are all going to be different. That's one answer, but that's not a good enough answer. The next answer I had was, okay, bringing down civilization will kill a lot of people, but allowing civilization to continue kills a lot of people. It depends on your perspective. I asked the former director of Food First, Anuradha Mittal, if the people of India would be better off if the U.S. or global economy disappeared tomorrow, and she laughed and said, of course. And the example she gave was there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. So there are people starving to death right now in India so that people in Europe can have dog food and tulips. And I'm sure you know this, that during the Great Potato Famine, Ireland was exporting grain to Europe, or to England. And during most of the famines that are taking place now and have taken place recently, exporting food to Europe, lima beans. So the point is, from whose perspective? From the perspective of marlins and swordfish, they're like, God damn, bring it down now. And prey dogs are like, yep, yep, yep. And polar bears are like, damn straight. And subsistence farmers around the world would be better off immediately. If once again, whatever we mean. Subsistence farmers would be better off. The rural poor around the world would be better off immediately. The indigenous would be better off immediately. The urban poor, and I don't mean to gloss over this, the urban poor would be even more screwed than they are now. And the urban rich, fuck them. I mean, they're the problem anyway. So that's the second response. The third response I had is that all this nastiness, as civilization comes down, whether we help it come down or not, all this nastiness, I can guarantee 90 or 95% or 100% of the nastiness is going to come because those whose lifestyles are already killing the planet attempt to maintain those lifestyles. And a great example is we always hear, oh, the world's running out of water. Bullshit. Fucking bullshit. Goddamn fucking bullshit. I'll add five more words. The world is not running out of water. 90% of the water used by industrial humans is used by agriculture and industry. So people are dying of starvation, not because the world's running out of water, but because the water is being stolen for agriculture and industry, because the water is being stolen for lima bean farms, for cattle farms, for cattle ranches, for semiconductor, for Coca-Cola. And it's like if somebody were to blow the dams on the Colorado River, you know, there's 2 million dams in this country. There's 70,000 dams over 13.5 feet tall, 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall, which means if we only take out one of those 6.5 feet tall dams every day, it's going to take us 200 years to take them all out. People say, God, Derek, you're so non-compromised. It's like, okay, only 4 dams a day. Still take us 50 years. Anyway, if somebody were to take out the dams on the Colorado River, and the Colorado River were once again to reach the ocean, what a weird concept that is, you know, the capitalist press would bray as one that, oh, you know, the people are running out of water. They're going to die of thirst. It's like I wouldn't want to hear a single word of complaint so long as there still existed a single fountain in Las Vegas, so long as there still existed a single golf course, so long as there still existed a single irrigated alfalfa orchard or cotton field or citrus orchard. So long as there existed a single swimming pool, so long as there existed a single golf course, it's like they're thinking of raising the Shasta Dam in California. And the reason that Senator Feinstein gave was, it is Californians' God-given right to water their lawns. You know, there is no way to argue with that, except with explosives. The next answer that I have is one I want to read, which is the answer that finally made me happy, because I couldn't proceed with the book until I got past that point. All those things I said are true, but they're not sufficient. And for now, I've got an answer. If you've gotten this far in this book or in this conference, we probably agree that civilization's going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably have nothing to say to each other. God, how about those meds? We probably also agree that the crash is going to be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with all this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, the civilization's going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan. They can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate, or if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, those people growing medicinal plants in preparation for the end of civilization do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. They especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love, do what you can, do what best serves your land base. We need it all. That doesn't mean that everybody taking out dams and everybody working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. I love the phrase, dismantle globally, renew locally. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. That doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas or that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what will work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It's contiguous on two sides of the abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. 10th premise. The culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. I don't need to talk about that, do I? How are we doing for time? I'm sorry? About 10 minutes? Okay, I'll just speak like an auctioneer then. From the beginning, this culture... Oh, so you missed a really good section that comes right after that. Scott, it's great. It's about Angelina Jolie and her genitals. Yes. The culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. The culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. The Angelina Jolie story, very quickly. I don't know if this happens to you, but sometimes a vision of Angelina Jolie will just appear before me, and she'll sort of stand suspended in space. We should form a club. And it makes me happy. It used to scare me, actually, back when she was with Billy Bob, because I don't know if you know this, but each had a vial of the other's blood around their neck. That's really creepy. And then do you know where she has his name tattooed? Oh, my God, I bet she was wishing his name was Ed. Speaking of genitals, did you know that Nicole Kidman does not like to wear underwear? I read that in a newspaper, so it must be true. Does anybody know whose land, or does anybody know what's the indigenous name for this place? No, this place, this specific place. It's like, I think it's really insane that I know what is on Angelina Jolie's genitals and what is not on Nicole Kidman's, but it took me 2 years of living where I do to learn that there was a massacre of about 250 Indians about 2 miles from where I live at a place called Yontaket. Then if you go over here another mile, there's a massacre at a place called Hawanket, a massacre over here at a place called Achillet. It's crazy that I know about Brad and Angelina, and I know about Pedro Martinez, and I know about Mike Piazza, and I know about Kevin Minch, who's hit 7 home runs in 7 days, but I can't name 10 species of edible plants and fungi who live within 100 yards of my home. That is, but if insane is to be out of touch with physical reality, that's insane. I mean, I can't name what is around my home. I mean, there's huckleberry, blackberry, salal, salmonberry, thimbleberry, huckleberry. Oh, and then those big red mushrooms with the white dots. I was thinking, if I eat one of those, I can take out a dam all by myself. I can take it out with one finger. Anyway, so that's the section that you missed. Okay, the 11th premise is from the beginning, this culture, civilization, has been a culture of occupation. And, of course, my American Indian friends say, what the hell took you so long to figure this one out? Yeah, I want to read this, too. Okay, well, then we have an insoluble problem here. If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? We'd watch television, by gum. What would we all do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. And what would we do if they then instituted laws allowing them to put a significant portion, say one-third, of all Jewish males from the ages of 18 and 35 into concentration camps? What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist or following Mussolini corporate party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Here's my secret fantasy, which I guess won't be secret now, which is that the next time they have one of those WTO meetings, all the cops turn around and start shooting at the WTO representatives. Because they have much more in common class-wise with the protesters than they do with the representatives. But, of course, the reason that can't happen is because that would be sending violence up the hierarchy, which is blasphemy. Anyway, would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Substitute the word African-American for Jewish and ask yourself the same questions. Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? What if they did this because, hell, I can't finish that sentence because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and toxify the landscape and water supplies? If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forests, and from there to the boardrooms and to the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them the marching orders? I mean, if they were space aliens who came down from outer space and were changing the climate, and they were vacuuming the oceans, and they were deforesting the planet, and they were putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk, but they were giving us tomatoes in January. If they were space aliens who were doing this, we would know exactly what to do. Or if they were Islamo-fascists, or, I mean, if the Iraqis had invaded, they were this close to invading. You know, if the Iraqis were erecting all these dams, we would know what to do. We'd grab our camo outfits, we would grab our AK-47s, we would head off to the fort. Wrong audience. Am I the only person here with an AK-47? I shared the stage with Ward Churchill one time, and he was in the audience during my talk, and when I said, am I the only person here with an AK-47, the place is silent, and then I hear this voice go, nope. Okay. So maybe your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'll fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape, but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put dozens of carcinogens in the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? How many people in here have had someone you love die of cancer? It's about 70%. It's a disease of civilization, of course. Would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion that their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? Would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues? Or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your body, when precisely will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold which you finally take a stand. If you can't or won't give that threshold, why not? So what I would like to do now, actually, is I would like to bash hope very briefly and then read two very brief things. A few years ago, a friend of mine called me up and said, you know, this work is just, she was crying, and she works on toxic issues in Northern California. She said, you know, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. I said, yeah, it'll do that. She said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She has a death urge, doesn't it? That's what she said. I said, yeah, it does. She said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is, unless it's stopped. Then she said, we're not going to make it to some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And I thought a moment, and then I said, the thing I knew all along was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I knew that was the best thing I could say is because about 12 or 13 years ago, I was undergoing a similar collapse. So I was just bursting into tears all the time over the death of the salmon, the sturgeon, and the bull trout. And a lot of my environmentalist friends were saying, take some time off, Derek. The problems will still be there when you come back. But I knew I had to keep pushing. And one day, I called up this friend of mine. I was sobbing. I called this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian writer and activist. And I said, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. She said, yeah, it'll do that. And I said, dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it's stopped, dominant culture is going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it's stopped. And I said, we're not going to make it to some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she waited a moment, and then she said the best possible thing she could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best possible thing she could say is because it normalized my despair, and it let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. You know, we all struggle so hard. You know, there's this assumption that you know, if you recognize how bad things are, that you have to go around being miserable all the time. This one woman wrote me an email one time. She wanted to know how my anger at the dominant culture affected my sex life. And, I mean, I was so tempted to write back and say, you know what, that's a question to which you will never know the answer. And her question was based on the idea that anger's a shotgun. But, I mean, once again, there's this idea that if you recognize how miserable things are or how bad things are, that you have to be miserable. But the truth is, I'm full of joy, and I'm full of sorrow, and I'm full of hate, and I'm full of rage, and I'm full of love, and I'm full of all these things. You know, I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we're really fucked, and that life is really, really good. And that we're really fucked. And that life is so good. And I recognize, you know, feeling all that, I recognize, or I felt, you know, that I could feel all those things, and they wouldn't kill me. Sorrow is just sorrow, and pain is just pain. And fear is just fear. And it's not the sorrow or even the pain that hurts so much as it's my resistance to it. But something even more important happens, which is I found out that I could feel all those things, and they would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. Not through threats, not through promises. One of the smartest things the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Want to move to a ghetto? Or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Want to get on a cattle car? Want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower? Or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you something very important, which is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. No, listen. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. That is a very good thing. You just added an hour to the talk. I wish. I'm so tempted to go there. One of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father was because, my abusive father, was because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason that she stayed with him is because of the false hope that he would change. False hopes bind us to unlivable situations, and they blind us to real possibilities. I mean, is there anybody really think that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we asked nicely? Does anybody really think Monsanto is going to stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely? I had some Democrats brought me to do a talk somewhere, and they said, what are you going to talk about tonight? And I said, well, I'm going to talk about bringing down civilization. And it's like I just hiked up my cheek and farted, you know? It's like, oh, they're just silence, and then noses wrinkle. And then somebody, could you please pass the hummus? It's really delicious. And they were saying that night, you know, if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, you know, does anybody really think that if we just get a Democrat in the White House, things would be good? And they were saying, you know, if we could just take over both houses of Congress, and I'm thinking, yeah, I wouldn't mind taking over both houses of Congress, but I don't think I mean the same thing you do. Anyway, so the problem, I mean, what are the false hopes that keep us bound to the system? What are the false hopes that keep us from resisting in the ways we want to? But the problem is not merely false hopes. I know I'm going over, so I'll speak even faster. The problem is hope itself is one of the problems. I was giving a talk in Colorado a couple years ago, and somebody shouted out, you know, what do you mean by hope? I was bashing hope. And somebody said, what do you mean by hope? I was like, oh, God, I don't know. I've been bashing it for years. I have no idea what I'm talking about. And so I asked them to define it, and they said hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency, is the definition the audience came up with. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. And that's how we use it in everyday language. I mean, I don't hope that I get some sleep tonight. I'm just going to do it. I will commit here in public that I'm going to sleep tonight. I don't hope I sleep. I'm going to just do it. Next time I get on a plane, I hope it doesn't crash. So if somebody says, I hope that coho salmon survive, what they're saying is, I have no power over where the coho salmon survive. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. I will do whatever it takes, and I mean whatever it takes, to make sure they survive. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. Thank you.
This presentation is brought to you by Submedia. You can check us out online at submedia.tv.